Sylacauga is a small town in central Alabama, nestled amid the rolling hills and forests of Talladega County. Back in the 1990s, this tight-knit community was so diminutive that it lacked fundamental establishments, such as motels or restaurants. The town's limited size fostered a culture where nearly everybody was familiar with each other. Within the context of small-town Alabama, individuals within the LGBTQ+ community often chose to conceal their identities. Many found solace in relocating to the more embracing city of Birmingham. In 1990, the world would come to learn exactly why. It was a quiet Saturday morning in Sylacauga, Alabama, on the 20th of February 1999. The tranquility was shattered when a burning car was discovered alongside Alabama 148. Firefighters and police were dispatched to the area, and when the flames were extinguished, they let out a collective sigh of relief to find that the vehicle was empty. Detectives quickly discovered that the burning car belonged to 39-year-old Billy Jack Gaither. Billy Jack Gaither was born on the 21st of January 1960. He was a member of a large family in central Alabama, with Marion and Annie as his parents. Growing up as one of seven siblings in a deeply religious household, attending church was a weekly ritual for the Gaither family. Of the four boys, Billy Jack was known for his kindness and his devotion to reading the illustrated Bible before bed, as well as singing in the church choir. With a bustling household, he always had somebody to play with, often enjoying fishing trips with his siblings on Lake Louise. It was during his upbringing that Billy Jack came to terms with his sexual orientation. Despite being aware of his own truth, he chose to keep this aspect of himself hidden from his conservative community and his religious family. However, Billy Jack's siblings soon enough recognized his identity, but his parents were none the wiser. As his brother Greg said, "We knew he was. We just knew." His sister Kathy was also a member of the LGBTQ+ community, which fostered a profound connection with her brother. Their relationship was characterized by mutual support and understanding, with Kathy playing a pivotal role in aiding Billy Jack's self-acceptance journey regarding his own sexual orientation. Eventually, after the 11th grade, Billy Jack made the decision to drop out of high school, but he was determined to continue his education and acquired his GED. Following Billy Jack's education, he enlisted in the Marines. Though his time of service was relatively brief due to health concerns, Billy Jack returned home and started to explore his identity more openly in the gay bars of Birmingham and Atlanta. While he was open about his sexuality in environments where he felt secure, he never sought to draw attention. Living in a small southern town will do that to people. Deeply concerned about hurting his parents, Billy Jack chose to keep this significant part of his life hidden, creating a barrier between his personal truth and the expectations of his religious upbringing. Despite his parents' lack of awareness about his personal life, Billy Jack shared a profound mutual respect with his mother and father. His father affectionately described him as the ideal son any parent could wish for, highlighting Billy Jack's exceptional character. As of 1999, Billy Jack lived with his disabled parents in their white clapboard house on Pelham Street in Sylacauga. He tirelessly attended to their every need, including cooking and cleaning. Each night, Billy Jack never went to bed without telling his parents goodnight and telling them how much he loved them. As Marion recalled, he would give you the shirt off his back. Despite often considering the possibility of leaving the confines of the small town for a more accepting environment in Birmingham, his devotion to his parents always prevented him. As his brother Randy said, Billy Jack was nothing if not reliable, so he stayed in Sylacauga with his parents. Within his bedroom, a portrayal of Vivian Leigh and Clark Gable in the classic Gone with the Wind adorned his walls. Meanwhile, the living room bore depictions of Jesus and the Ten Commandments, underscoring his strong spiritual convictions. Life for Billy Jack was peaceful, and it was routine. Every day he commuted almost 60 miles to his job at Russell's Athletic Distribution Center in Alexander City, where he worked loading and unloading materials off trucks. His commendable work ethic earned him a respected position, often leading him to stand in for his supervisor when needed. On the weekends, Billy Jack liked to visit the Tavern, a country music bar located along US Highway 280. The beer of choice was always Budweiser, and Billy Jack liked to nurse his beer for longer than the usual patron. He enjoyed playing pool and chatting with other familiar faces at the bar. Donna McKee, one of the barmaids, said, "He was a gentle soul. He had a calming presence. I never saw him get drunk, cause problems." Having frequented the bar for 2 decades, Billy Jack fostered a close relationship with the owner, Marion Hammond, who candidly recalled that he was the first openly gay man she had ever encountered. She remembered, "He knew what he was, and he was comfortable with it, and it was your problem if you weren't." Most nights, Billy Jack would linger in the bar until closing time at 2 a.m., before making his way back to his parents' home. Following the discovery of Billy Jack's torched car, detectives initiated efforts to establish contact with him. They reached out to his parents, Marion and Annie, and they reported that they hadn't seen him since the night before. They recounted how he had left home that night in his car to visit the tavern, but when they woke the next morning, they found that his bed hadn't been slept in, and he was nowhere to be found. Subsequently, detectives visited the tavern, where an employee recalled Billy Jack's presence on Friday night. Although he had spent a considerable time there, the staff member couldn't recall the exact moment he left, as she was preoccupied with attending to other guests. Detectives continued in their search for Billy Jack. Later that night at about 9 p.m, a young man was walking along the banks of Peckerwood Creek, a stream in Talladega County, Alabama. Peckerwood Creek is situated along an infrequently traversed, poorly lit highway, flanked by quarries known for producing marble and granite for headstones. Historically, the creek had served as a site for baptisms. Approximately 200 yards from a desolate road, this man was navigating through scattered debris, including discarded cans and bullets littering the ground. In the distance, a concrete slab protruding into the waters, a remnant of a dismantled bridge, came into view. As the man drew closer, he discovered something smouldering. It was a charred body atop a stack of burning tires. Upon receiving the man's 911 call, police swiftly arrived at the scene. Officer Michael Taylor, who was in his third year in the department, recounted the grisly discovery as gruesome and heinous. He said it was the worst crime scene he had ever seen in his entire life. The area was swiftly cordoned off with crime scene tape, as the victim's body was transported to the medical examiner's office. Subsequent examination revealed the extent of the brutality inflicted upon the victim. It was determined that the man had suffered a slit throat and severe blunt force trauma to the head, presumably caused by a heavy object. The impact had resulted in 3 fractures in his skull, leading to the collapse of his facial structure. Additionally, burn marks were found on the body, indicating post-mortem infliction. The extent of the injuries painted a picture of an exceptionally brutal and prolonged assault. Based on the victim's appearance, detectives knew that they had just found Billy Jack Gaither. Once the body was identified as Billy Jack, detectives began their investigation, but it wouldn't be long before they got their first lead. That night, a concerned individual named Joey Breedlove contacted them. He relayed that his friend, Charles Butler Sr., had disclosed that his son had allegedly confessed to Billy Jack's murder. The son in question, 21-year-old Charles Butler Jr., had returned home in the early morning hours of Saturday, visibly distraught. According to Joey's account, Butler tearfully admitted to his father that they had taken somebody's life, proclaiming, "We killed somebody. I kicked a queer's ass." Butler had then disclosed to his father that he and another friend, 25-year-old Stephen Eric Mullis, had killed Billy Jack because he was gay. Despite Butler Sr.'s reluctance to directly involve detectives, he confided in his friend, Joey, regarding his son's alleged confession. Without delay, Joey promptly called police. Stephen Eric Mullins was well known to law enforcement at the time, having racked up numerous charges dating back to when he was a juvenile. After serving 2.5 years in prison for burglary and forgery, he crossed paths with Billy Jack Gaither in a local bar. Despite their different backgrounds, the two men had struck up something of a friendship over the past year. They both drank in the tavern together, and Billy Jack would drive Mullins to the grocery store. Mullins was known around the town as a skinhead wannabe, who projected an intimidating demeanour. His shaved head, racist-themed t-shirts, and racist tattoos often led to confrontations. While Mullins was a familiar face at the tavern, his extremist views and racist remarks often resulted in him being kicked out of the premises. He once boasted to a fellow patron about wearing a KKK t-shirt and deliberately positioning himself against a restaurant window so that black diners could see. According to Larry Hammond, who worked at the tavern, Mullins acted tough but backed down quickly if he were ever challenged. He remarked, "He tried to walk around like a bully, but he wasn't. He was mostly talk." The sentiment was shared by others, including Bruce Jones, who recounted an incident from the previous fall. During a night at the tavern, Mullins repeatedly shouldered Bruce in the back when he walked past, but the provocation stopped short of escalation. Having lived with Butler's half-brother for several years, Mullins had been acquainted with him. However, it was only a month earlier that the two men began spending time together. Butler was described as the more reserved of the two. Standing just over 5 feet 4 inches tall, Mullins, who was over 6 foot, towered over him. He was a high school dropout and construction worker. You can't beat a classic whodunit, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey. In this mobile puzzle game, you get to play as the eclectic June Parker, an amateur detective trying to solve her sister's murder and uncovering some family mysteries along the way. Engage your observation skills by searching for hidden clues and uncover key pieces of information as the mystery unfolds. June's Journey is set in the glamorous 1920s and it has the most beautifully intricate scenes. There's actually over 1,000 scenes that are filled with hidden clues. I've been playing June's Journey for well over a year now, and I find myself playing it late at night as a way to unwind. What's super fun is that you actually get to build your own island estate and add loads of cool features to it. You can even join a detective club. I'm currently on Volume 4, Chapter 4, where June needs to find clues on a boat. Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Following Joey's revelation of Butler's confession to his father, Butler was arrested and detained overnight. The next morning, he told detectives that he couldn't sleep, and that God told him he needed to make a full confession. Butler was taken into the interrogation room, where he began to confess. He recounted how on the night of Billy Jack's murder, he was at the tavern with his father, when Mullins entered the bar, accompanied by Billy Jack. Butler said that while he was friends with Mullins, he had never met Billy Jack before. He said that Mullins walked over to him and struck up a conversation. He asked whether he wanted to go with him and Billy Jack to another nightclub. Butler agreed and the three men left the bar together. Instead of going to another nightclub, however, Butler told detectives that they went to an isolated woodland in neighbouring Clay County. The three men sat around drinking some beers and chatting. According to Butler, Billy Jack made a pass at him, although he admitted that he never grabbed or touched him. He said to detectives, "Well, sir, he started, you know, queer stuff, you know, and I just didn't want no part of it." Recalling the incident to detectives, Butler admitted to kicking Billy Jack several times. He said that Billy Jack fell to the ground and he kicked him two or three more times. After Billy Jack struggled to regain his footing, Butler excused himself to use the bathroom, leaving the scene briefly. As he walked away, he said he heard a commotion from behind and turned around to see Mullins jumping on Billy Jack. He then described how Mullins lunged at Billy Jack, causing blood to gush from his throat. Billy Jack's throat had been slashed with a penknife, yet he was still alive. Despite Billy Jack's desperate pleas for mercy and attempts to rise, Mullins stabbed him twice in the ribcage. Subsequently, Mullins forced Billy Jack into the trunk of his own vehicle. With Mullins assuming the driver's seat and Butler seated in the front, they drove to Mullins' trailer, where they grabbed tires, kerosene, and an axe handle. Proceeding to Peckerwood Creek, Mullins forcibly dragged Billy Jack from the trunk, his clothing drenched in blood as he clutched his neck. In the dim light, the grim sight became apparent to Billy Jack. The presence of tires, kerosene, and Mullins holding an axe handle. Acutely aware of the dire circumstances, Billy Jack pleaded desperately for his release, vowing to keep what happened a secret. In response, Mullins hurled homophobic slurs at him. Seizing a fleeting chance to break free, Billy Jack forcefully shoved Mullins, sending him tumbling into the creek, before jumping into the driver's seat of his own car. Meanwhile, Butler claimed that he fled into the nearby woods. Mullins swiftly recovered from the water, dangling the car keys before retrieving Billy Jack from the vehicle. He then struck Billy Jack again and again with the axe handle. During the interrogation, Butler acknowledged his complicity in the subsequent events. He confessed to helping burn Billy Jack's body atop the pile of tires and then setting fire to Billy Jack's car, all in a bid to obliterate any incriminating evidence. Shortly after Butler was arrested, Mullins was also picked up and informed of Butler's confession. He too sat down with detectives to offer them his version of what happened that night. He told detectives that the murder of Billy Jack had in fact been planned for 2 weeks by himself and Butler. He said he thought he could trust Butler because he was just as homophobic as he was. According to Mullins, Billy Jack had made a pass at him around 2 weeks earlier over the phone, and from that moment on he began plotting to kill him. He later said, "He broke that respect line. It started eating at me and it bothered me a lot. He let Butler in on his plans, and he said that he wanted to be a part of it, but Mullins admitted that he never physically carried out the murder." Mullins said that on the night of the murder, he had called up Billy Jack and asked him to pick him up so they could go to the bar. Billy Jack collected him at about 7 p.m. and they drove around while Mullins drank some bottles of beer. They then drove over to the tavern where Mullins called Butler. He asked him to meet them at the bar and said that he was with Billy Jack. He said, "I told him what I was thinking about doing, killing Billy Jack." Butler arrived and according to Mullins, they lured Billy Jack into the woods under the pretense of engaging in sexual activity. Mullins admitted to slitting Billy Jack's throat, but contended that it was Butler's suggestion to transport him to Peckerwood Creek to burn him. Contrary to Butler's account of events, Mullins claimed that Butler had offered him a pocket knife to slit Billy Jack's throat a second time. Instead, he confessed to bludgeoning Billy Jack to death with an axe handle, recounting that he continued the assault until he was physically exhausted. On the 1st of March, both Butler and Mullins were officially charged with the murder of Billy Jack. Their bail was set at $500,000 each. despite their respective confessions. Butler had reportedly communicated to his family that he initially anticipated a mere physical altercation with Billy Jack. His stepmother attested that she had never once heard her son express any form of animosity towards members of the LGBTQ plus community. She commented, "It wasn't a big issue here, but it might have been when he was out with his friends." His grandmother, Willene White, also expressed disbelief that Butler had known what was going to happen to Billy Jack. She stated, "He ain't ever been in a lot of trouble. He's just a typical boy. It's hard for me to believe he did it." Upon the revelation of the gruesome details surrounding Billy Jack's murder, the entire nation was left in a state of horror, while the LGBTQ plus community was particularly gripped by fear. Individuals living in small southern towns were especially affected, feeling a chilling sense of proximity to the tragic incident, as if it could have easily been any of them in Billy Jack's place. Some said that there was an unwritten rule in rural Alabama about keeping their sexuality hidden. The memory of Matthew Shepard's tragic death in a homophobic attack in Wyoming the previous year was still fresh in people's minds. Likewise, the racially motivated murder of James Byrd Jr. during the same period served as a stark reminder of the prevalence of hate-fueled violence in society. Compounding the tragedy was the fact that Alabama was among 19 states that didn't have hate crime laws that included provisions for offences related to sexual orientation. This legislative gap created a profound dilemma, as the nature of the crime clearly pointed towards a hate crime, yet the legal framework fell short in addressing it adequately. Consequently, the inability to file hate crime charges, despite the evident bias-driven nature of the murder, underscored the pressing need for comprehensive and inclusive hate crime legislation. Bruce Steele, editor of The Advocate, an LGBTQ plus magazine, said, "There are a lot of people still out there who believe that gay and lesbian people are a threat. Until that is educated away, these sorts of things will continue to happen." By this point, state rep Alvin Holmes had already filed a bill that would extend Alabama's laws to cover hate crimes motivated by homophobia. He was moved to file the bill in the wake of Matthew Shepard's murder. Upon learning of Billy Jack's murder, he reintroduced a bill that would increase the penalties for somebody convicted of a crime motivated by the victim's sexual orientation. He had previously attempted to introduce this bill, but it failed because there was no documentation that such crimes occurred. However, that was only because Alabama didn't recognize such murders to be hate crimes. In the wake of Billy Jack's murder, people demanded for Alabama to up their stance on hate crimes. Lori Wood of the Southern Poverty Law Center commented that sexual orientation was becoming one of the top motivations behind bias crimes. She said that the murders against members of the LGBTQ plus community were among the most violent. She stated, "In attacks against homosexuals, often we see the overkill approach, where there is so much anger directed at that person that the attack is overly brutal. Billy Jack's murder certainly had the hallmarks of a hate crime. In several cases of this nature, perpetrators often attempt to rationalize their actions by alleging that the victim had made unwelcome sexual advances. This was precisely the defense that Butler and Mullins put forth." Upon the revelation of their motives, Marion and Annie struggled to come to terms with the shocking reality. The discovery of their son's secret life struck them with disbelief, particularly Marion, who grappled with denial regarding his son's sexuality. He even cited a past relationship with a woman as evidence that his son was straight. His mother Annie said, "If he was gay, he sure never showed it. He never flaunted himself as being gay or talked about it. And whether he was or not, it don't make me love him any less." She seemed to acknowledge Billy Jack's sexuality by adding, "Whatever he did, he never brought it home." Marion then added, If he was gay, he kept it from me. I couldn't have asked for a better son. He was always there for me. He was very protective of his mama and me. He said that he wanted his son to be remembered as a loving and caring person who loved life. Marian added that in his soul he believed that his son was in heaven. As newspapers began reporting on the alleged motivation, Billy Jack had hit on Butler and Mullins. Those who knew his truth came to his defense. They all said that Billy Jack wasn't the type of man to hit on somebody. As the owner of the tavern, Marian Hammond said, he didn't ever put anybody in an awkward position. Billy Jack's brother, Ricky, agreed, stating, they may have come up and talked to Billy Jack, because Billy Jack wouldn't approach anybody that didn't approach him. He didn't push himself on people. With Butler and Mullins behind bars, the creek where Billy Jack lost his life became a makeshift memorial. On Friday morning, a pair of holy men and a woman of the cloth cast blessed water and laid a golden floor. They read prayers for commendation at the time of death from the Book of Matthew. Timothy Holder, rector at Grace Episcopal Church, said, evil has happened here. It is very important to face evil immediately with love. Love will conquer it, and that's why we're here. As autumn sets in and Thanksgiving approaches, it's time to grab your seasonal decorations. The familiar struggle of locating the right storage bin can be a thing of the past. Introducing Smart Labels, your solution for hassle-free organization. No more opening multiple bins, making a mess, and feeling frustrated. With Smart Labels, easily locate your items within your storage bins. How does it work? Simply purchase their color-coded and QR-coded Smart Labels from their website, Amazon, or Walmart. Then download the Smart Labels app from the Apple App Store or Google Play. Attach the Smart Label to your storage bin, scan it with the app, and assign a specific name such as Thanksgiving. You can even describe the contents for easy reference. Say goodbye to spending precious time rummaging through boxes to find your Thanksgiving or fall decorations. Visit qrsmartlabels.com now to simplify your storage organization. On the 10th of March, people from all across Alabama crammed into the Covenant Metropolitan Church to remember Billy Jack and to demand an end to hate crimes perpetrated against members of the LGBTQ+ community. There were people from all walks of life at the service, and Reverend Marge Ragona said that the sighs amazed and gladdened her. To applause, she said, this is far beyond my wildest dreams. We are amazed so many felt you needed to be here, just as we needed to be here. She urged the crowd not to remain silent in the wake of Billy Jack's murder, and denounced Christians who use the Bible as justification to treat members of the LGBTQ+ community differently. During the service, many talkers urged legislators to add such crimes to the state's list of hate crimes. After the two-hour service, people lit small candles and stood outside the church, where they sang This Little Light of Mine. There was a little 9-year-old boy there, Max Griffiths, holding up a sign that read, God loves all people. His mother, Leah, said that it was important for her son to know that you don't kill people, regardless of who they are, and especially for what they believe in. Across the street, a handful of protesters from the Westboro Baptist Church in Kansas held signs attacking members of the LGBTQ+ community. Some even specifically targeted Billy Jack. In March, Mullins and Butler were indicted on capital murder charges by a grand jury. This meant that if convicted, they could both be facing execution in Alabama's electric chair. Butler pleaded innocent by reason of insanity, while Mullins just pleaded innocent. The next month, President Bill Clinton announced he was endorsing a bill that would expand federal hate crime laws to include offences based on sexual orientation. Congress had failed to act on a similar legislation just the year beforehand. The president also ordered the Education Department to begin collecting data on hate crimes in college campuses. By this point, there had been numerous protests all throughout the United States, and various states were demanding that the state law be amended as well. In May, an Alabama House committee voted to add hate crimes based on sexual orientation to be added to the state's hate crime law. However, the following month, the bill failed. Despite this, Representative Alvin Holmes said that it would not be his last with the measure. He said that he was going to keep fighting for a change in law. On the 24th of June, Mullins returned to court alone. The courtroom was filled with Billy Jack's loved ones, as Mullins changed his plea to guilty. He stood up at the podium and stated, "I kidnapped Mr. Gaither, forced him into the car, and killed him intentionally." Mullins had agreed to the plea to avoid the electric chair, but prosecutors were going to be seeking a sentence of life in prison without parole. According to his defense attorney, Rod Giddings, his client and butler had been motivated to kill Billy Jack because he allegedly made a pass at them. He distanced his client to the killers of Matthew Shepard and said that he wasn't going out to target a gay person. That same day, Butler also appeared in court and withdrew his insanity defense, but still kept his not guilty plea. After the court hearings, Billy Jack's brother, William, said that he wanted to see both men sentenced to death. Billy Jack's father, Marion, didn't agree, commenting, "I don't believe in the death penalty. I think it will be harder for them in prison." The guilty plea meant that just Butler would be standing trial alone. Much like Mullins, he too had been offered a plea deal. It called for him to plead guilty in exchange for a guarantee he wouldn't get the death penalty. Butler decided against the plea, which meant he would be proceeding to trial. According to his defense attorney, they were confident in their defense. While at first Butler was going for an insanity defense, they had decided instead to present a defense that he was innocent. It was their argument that while Butler was there when Billy Jack was killed, he didn't participate in it. The murder trial began on the 3rd of August 1999. During opening statements, defense attorney Billy Hill claimed that the three men were drinking beer in the woods when Billy Jack propositioned Butler. He admitted that Butler was the first to hit Billy Jack that night, but maintained that everything else he did was under orders from Mullins. He described his client as a small-framed boy who was intimidated by Mullins, who stood at 6'1" and weighed 200 pounds. According to defense attorney Hill, Mullins was solely responsible for Billy Jack's death. He said that he and Billy Jack had developed a relationship of sorts and had been talking on a regular basis. Prosecutor Fred Thompson, during his opening statements, acknowledged that Butler didn't cut Billy Jack's throat or beat him to death. However, he said that he played a key role in the murder. He went on to say that Billy Jack was gay, and that was the only reason that he was killed. He stated, "It was pure, simple hatred. Hatred of someone perceived to be different." He said that Butler had aided in the crime partly by setting the tires on fire and burning Billy Jack's car to hide evidence. He told the jury that somebody didn't need to be the trigger man to be guilty of capital murder. He stated, "Not one time are you going to hear evidence that Charles Butler did anything to assist Billy Jack Gaither. He was there. He participated." While the defense team claimed that Mullins had not participated in the murder, the prosecution said it was their theory that the murder had actually been planned. The trial got underway promptly and the jury heard the tape of the confession Butler had made to Detective Kelly Johnson. Butler's father, Charles Butler Sr., testified that his son returned home that night at about 3 a.m. and began crying. He then recounted the murder of Billy Jack, telling his father, "We just killed a fellow." His father said that his son told him, "I kicked a queer's ass." Prosecutor Jeff Willis then moved quickly to show that Butler had in fact plotted with Mullins to kill Billy Jack 2 weeks before the murder. Stephen Eric Mullen's confession was entered into evidence, where he said that the murder was planned by the two men. Mullins was then called to the witness stand. He testified that Butler didn't strike the fatal blows that killed Billy Jack, but said that he had spoken to him in the past about wanting to kill Billy Jack. He said that he plotted to kill Billy Jack to steal his money, and because he had made a pass at him. He testified, "I was looking to get some money from him because I didn't have any and was unemployed." In his words, he invited Butler to help, because he didn't like queers either. As he testified, Butler stared at him from the defense table intently. Mullins described how they lured Billy Jack to the forest with a promise of a threesome. He admitted that he had carried out the murder himself, and said that Butler ran away when he was beating Billy Jack to death. He said that Butler returned after he called him several times, and said that he then offered him his penknife in case he wanted to slit Billy Jack's throat again. He testified, "I told him it was good enough." Defense attorney Hill then asked Mullins, "Are you telling these ladies and gentlemen that one of the reasons you set Billy Jack Gaither up was because he was gay?" Mullins replied, "Yes, sir." He was then asked, "And you hate gays?" Mullins responded, "Yes, sir." The prosecution then summoned Jimmy Dean to the witness stand to challenge Mullins' claims of being prejudiced against the LGBTQ plus community. They alleged an alternative narrative, suggesting that Mullins himself might have been concealing his true sexual orientation. They theorized that Billy Jack may not have been killed because he was gay, but instead because he and Mullins had been in something of a relationship. Mullins was afraid that this would become public knowledge in the town. Jimmy Dean, an openly gay man, testified that he had oral sex with Mullins during a party the previous fall. Two women also testified about the party and said they saw Jimmy and Mullins dancing together. They said that Mullins was concerned about whether anybody from Sylacauga would see him at the party. Others testified that they knew Mullins had performed sex acts on other men for money. Mullins testified again following this testimony, and he admitted to being at the party. He denied questions from defense attorney Hill about having oral sex or having a sexual relationship with Billy Jack. The defense attorney then said, "For a man who hates gays, you seem to hang out with gays an awful lot." Butler was called to testify on his own behalf, and he stuck to the same story he had told detectives. He said that when Mullins slit Billy Jack's throat, he was in shock and didn't know what to do. He said that he only went along with what was happening that night because he was terrified of Mullins and didn't want him to think that he was going to rat on him. He testified that he didn't hate Billy Jack and that he never wanted him to die. Two of Mullins' cellmates backed up the claims that Butler didn't know that Billy Jack was going to die that night. One said that Mullins told him, "You should have seen the look on Butler's face when I knocked Billy Jack's teeth out. He turned white as a ghost." After the testimony was presented, it was time for closing arguments. Prosecutor Thompson told the jury that both Mullins and Butler were two pieces of evil. He said that while Butler may not have carried out the murder physically, he was there every step of the way, aiding and assisting. Defense attorney Hill, on the other hand, referred to his client as an innocent boy, telling the jury, "He did not kill him. Stephen Eric Mullins did. Mullins is a hustler. He's hustled my client. He's hustled Billy Jack Gaither. He's hustled the district attorney. And he's trying to hustle you." The jury deliberated for just 2.5 hours before finding Charles Butler Jr. guilty of Billy Jack's murder. After Billy Jack's family requested that the death penalty be taken off the table, Butler was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Outside of court, Marion said the family were pleased. He stated, "I can't see taking another human's life no matter what." He then shared his desire for his son to be remembered as one of the finest sons a man could want. The following day, Mullins returned to court to be formally sentenced. The details of the crime were read aloud, following which Mullins was asked how he felt. He responded, "Very sorry that it happened. I'm sorry. I wish I could change it all." Steve Mullins was then sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Both Butler and Mullins were carted off to begin serving their life sentences. In December of 1999, Mullins did an interview with 2020 and said that Billy Jack was spending eternity in hell because he was gay. He said that he had repented and that he was carrying no guilt for the murder because God had forgiven him. Butler did his own interview with PBS Frontline, and much like Mullins, he appeared to have no guilt. He stated, "Billy Jack started talking about some gay issues, wanting to have a threesome or whatever. Steve jumped on him and cut his throat there. I didn't even know the man. For him to be hitting on me, tempers just flared. It's like he didn't have no respect." Over his incarceration, Mullins allegedly disavowed neo-Nazism. He said that at one point he believed that every other race other than white was evil and didn't belong on Earth. He also said he felt as though the person who killed Billy Jack was another person, not him. On the 26th of February 2019, 45-year-old Stephen Mullins was stabbed to death in a housing area at the St. Clair Correctional Facility. He had been killed by 50-year-old Christopher Scott Jones, who was serving time for killing five men in Shelby County in 2008. In the days and weeks before his murder, Mullins had repeatedly asked for protection. He reported that he had been threatened with violence and couldn't live safely without protection housing. According to the Equal Justice Initiative, rather than be placed in a protective unit, Mullins was placed in a dorm known for violent and serious assaults. Although Mullins purportedly renounced his previous association with neo-Nazism, his visible racist tattoos potentially made him an easy target, particularly for an individual like Jones, who had previously taken the lives of five people. Billy Jack Gaither led a modest and harmonious existence, keeping his homosexuality somewhat discreet within his conservative Alabama community. He had every right to freely love whoever he chose, but found himself victim to the hate he was trying to prevent. Even today, Alabama's hate crime law does not apply to crimes committed on account of sexual orientation or gender identity. But that's not for a lack of trying. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my newest supporters up on Patreon, Stephanie and Rebecca. If you'd like to support Morbidology on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. And in exchange for your support, I upload bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that are on the regular podcast platforms. I also upload ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, which includes bonus audio, video, and case files, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card along with some cool merch. As you all know, Morbidology is a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you may be listening. Ratings and reviews are a super easy way to support an independent show that you like, and I genuinely do appreciate the feedback. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.